Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Morning. You all right? Me? Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for joining me. We're the Glorious Band, the Chosen Few, my band of brothers and sisters. You guys know who you are. You don't need any introduction. It is now 8 in the a.m. British Summer Time on Friday. Thank F, it's Friday. On the 24th of July in the year of our Lord, 2026. As always, I'm joined by my producer, Little Harry. How are you this morning? Good, sir.
Morning. Yeah, I'm all good.
Good. We're going to go through the headlines like usual today, but I'm joined by a returning guest, the good professor himself, one Mr. Edward Dutton. How are you, sir?
Hello. Yes, I'm okay. Yes, I'm all right. Yeah, I'm going to go on holiday. Going on holiday soon. Got my holiday coming with my family. We're going away at the end of the weekend.
Are you going somewhere very hot or?
We're going. Family trip to Auschwitz.
You're so deadpan, Ed. I have no idea whether you're joking or not.
I'm not joking.
Are you really?
It was my wife's idea. She'd always wanted to go. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go to Auschwitz with the kids.
And you can see all the things that the Soviets built in the late 40s. That'll be cool.
Exactly. This is what I'm really, really looking forward to. I was looking forward to seeing all things the Soviets built, and it should be interesting. So it should be. I mean that very, very sincerely. We're gonna go there.
No, it's something I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind visiting, in all honesty. It's not really top of my list, but yeah, I wouldn't mind going there. So one or two people in the office have been there.
It was funny how it happened. I said to my wife, "Concentrate and book us a holiday in a holiday camp." And she misheard me, and she thought I said, "Book us a holiday in a concentration camp." And so that from there, the holiday just sort of took place. I don't know, but never mind. I'll find a way through.
At least you didn't have to like go camping in a little tent in the forests outside Sobibor. I mean, at least there is some sort of infrastructure, I believe, in Auschwitz. Around Auschwitz.
Exactly. I should emphasise, we're not actually, because when I told my mum about this, she got confused and she thought I was saying that we were actually staying in kind of like an Auschwitz-themed hotel where there would be bunk beds and you know, weird soap and whatever.
Actual barrack houses on the site.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But that happened when I was when Callum came and we did our film about Finland. We stayed in a tuberculosis sanatorium that had been turned into a tuberculosis sanatorium-themed hotel. It was just staying literally in what it would have been like to be in a tuberculosis sanatorium in the 30s. But it's not like that. We're staying in a hotel in Krakow.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoy it. All right. Genuinely, let's crack on with this then. So what's in the legacy corporate lamestream media today? What's that evil cabal of Fleet Street editors trying to tell us is or isn't important? What are they lying to us about by omission, if by nothing else? We've got Burnham eager to get drilling. So no Sternham Burnham, King Bumham of the North. He's going to drill baby drill. And TARDIS fit for a king. That's just a story of, there's a picture there, the Commonwealth Games kicked off in Glasgow, of all places. And for like the opening ceremony thing, which seems to be increasingly more surreal, don't they, and elaborate. It seems there was, I didn't watch it, but this is on the front of quite a few papers. They had a mock-up of the Doctor's TARDIS and the King and Queen came out of it. There you go. So that's what that's referring to. TARDIS fit for a king. All right. The Times. Let's start then. Burnham eager to get drilling in the North Sea. Industry experts green light. Oh, sorry. Industry expects green light to open up new fields. So for me, Ed.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer. I don't really buy into that man-made CO2 drives climate change. So for me, it's an absolute no-brainer for our energy security to drill in the North Sea. I don't see any cogent, reasonable argument not to. What's your feelings on all of that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this, from what I've read, the level of CO2 follows the warming or something rather than the other way round. So I get the impression that this is nonsense. I've seen convincing evidence that the change in climate is to do with sunspot activity, which is across time. We've seen that whenever there's low levels of sunspots, it's cold. And whenever there's high levels of sunspots, i.e. massive explosions on the sun, it's hot. So I don't think it's man-made. And I think the idea that it is man-made is this kind of semi-religious idea that we can control things and that we can behave in ways that influence the gods and whatever. And it goes back to that. So it's nonsense. We shouldn't have stopped drilling in the North Sea. It wrecked Aberdeen, for example, where I used to live, that they stopped drilling in the North Sea. And now they're saying, did you read about this, Bo? They're saying that the lack of pollution is itself making it hotter. Did you read about this? The sort of all the pollutants in the atmosphere were stopping the sun's rays and the sun's heat from fully penetrating. And now that there is less pollution, that's the reason for all of these heat waves. So if anything, we need more pollution because it's far too hot. So the whole thing is a nonsense, which I think is just grounded in a kind of religious Christian sort of idea that there is free will and we have to negotiate with the gods and we can behave in certain ways to get them to do what we want. It's rubbish from what I can see and from various scientists I've read. So yeah, I think we need to drill and get energy out and hopefully release lots of pollutants and therefore stop all this global warming that's just been going on.
It's the only prudent thing to do, really, isn't it? I think.
Because it's too hot. I mean, when I was in the UK last month, it was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it was something like 36 degrees in London. It was, and you know, on certain underground lines in the tube, there's no air conditioning. Like, there's no air conditioning, as I understand it, on the central line.
Yeah.
And I had a dinner in the city of London at Mercer's Hall or somewhere. I'm not going to go to that. And 2/3 of the people that were supposed to go to this dinner didn't turn up. Because it was just, it's like 200 out of 300 people didn't cut, because it was just insane. We don't want that. So we need more energy so we can all have air conditioning and there's the energy for us to be able to have it. They're saying that the lights almost went out on the, I think, was it 23rd of June? It was so bad. It was so hot. There was so much problems with electricity or use of air conditioning or whatever. The lights almost went out. We almost had a blackout. That's how bad it is. So we need more energy.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I saw a thing. Let's quickly talk about the climate hoax a bit more. There was a thing. I usually leave this right to the end of the show, don't I, on this day in history. There was one factoid here. It's very apt. Here we go. Look. On this day in 2019, global warming is fastest in 2,000 years, and scientific consensus that humans are the cause is at 99%, according to three major reports published in journals Nature and Nature Geoscience. Okay, a little bit of the history of that as well. That going back to the 1990s, research that was funded by the UN. To find that CO2 drove climate change, or rather man-made CO2 does drive climate change. And ever since then, in the 90s, the so-called hockey stick, there's also, you may know about this sort of data and science. And so periodically, we get things exactly like that, where it says, the debate is over, the science is in, all the scientists, or 99% of the scientists agree, there is no doubt that we're in almost a runaway spiral of temperatures going up, and it's because of CO2, specifically man-made CO2. And whenever I see that, I don't buy it. I always think, no. Drill into exactly who the scientists are, exactly who was funding their research, exactly who is peddling the publishing of their results, etc., etc., etc. When it boils down to it, exactly as you said, Ed, it's much more likely that the sun's weather patterns, the sun's different phases drives our climate much more than man-made CO2. If man-made CO2 is, well, CO2 in total is 470 parts per million in our atmosphere, and a man-made CO2 is maybe half of that, and that's at an all-time low on the scale of millions of years. We're actually in an ice age. We're just in an interglacial period within an ice age, and the Earth's cycles are on the scale of hundreds of thousands of years, usually. Go on.
In scientific terms, the theory that makes sense of the most is inherently the best theory. It's the most parsimonious theory. So if you say, well, okay, yeah, it's getting warm at the moment and we're putting this down to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere or whatever, or pollutants or that sort of thing. That's very interesting. But how do you explain the previous warm period? How do you explain, for example, the medieval warm period? How do you explain the Roman warm period? And the answer is it seems to relate to sunspots and things like that. It's nothing to do with pollutants. So wouldn't it make more sense? The more parsimonious explanation would explain everything, would explain all of the warm periods rather than just this particular warm period. Secondly, we were thinking in the 70s that we were going to get into a new ice age, that it was too cold. and then suddenly they manifested this idea in the late 80s that there was global warming. Thirdly, with the science, there's a difference between science, which is the pursuit of truth, and the Science Guild. If you read Thomas Kuhn's research, well, he said what happens is there becomes this idea, it becomes popular, then everybody shifts over to that idea, and then inherently the majority of scientists, the overwhelming majority, are going to believe it because it's in the interest of their career to basically keep their heads down and shut up and conform to whatever the dominant way of thinking is. The fact that the majority of scientists think it is completely irrelevant. The majority of scientists used to believe in Newtonian physics. Then Newtonian physics was shown to be incorrect at the subatomic level. And then gradually, it took a long time, but they shifted over, and they shifted over on mass eventually to Einsteinian physics. And there's many, many other examples of that. So it means nothing that the majority of scientists say something. At any given time, the majority of scientists say something, and they will almost certainly be wrong, because we learn more and we understand more and we gather more information and we nuance things more. And so whatever the majority of scientists are saying at any given time is probably wrong. And as for the journals, well, the journals are the most mainstream and therefore the most ideologically captured of any journal. Those high status journals will inherently reflect what the Science Guild is saying. But the fact that the Science Guild is saying it is completely irrelevant. I mean, some people say, oh, appeal to authority, it's inherently good because, look, you if I ask you to describe the nature of the, you know, what are neutrons made of?
Right? Yeah, you ask me, like, quarks, you mean, quarks or something?
Right, okay. So that would be the kind of thing that you would get from GCSE science. But there's much more complicated questions, such as, are quarks made of a wave or whatever, blah, 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 where you consult science. And so the guild. And so the idea is, okay, well, appeal to authority is a good thing. To some extent, that's true, with questions which aren't particularly controversial or politically incendiary. But with questions which are, then it's a very bad thing to appeal to the guild. Because the guild will be politically manipulated and taken over. So no, I've no time for. I think it's a much simpler explanation that this is. We've always had cold and warm periods throughout history.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Before we move on off of that, I think it's interesting when you look back through a deep time, the geological time periods of the Earth, got everything from sort of tropical conditions on Antarctica to a snowball Earth type scenario where glaciers would come down as far as Florida and stuff, as far as Spain, and that we now seem to be in some sort of absolute all-time low for CO2 in the atmosphere, absolute low, and as I say, we have ice ages that come and go on the scale of in the hundreds of thousands of years. And within those ice ages, you have interglacial periods where you're actually in an ice age, but the glaciers have receded quite far. And that almost certainly right now in 2026, the year of our Lord, we're in an interglacial period within an ice age, and therefore nowhere near a global warming, let alone a runaway global warming type situation. And yeah, I remember I've seen the clip of Leonard Nimoy. I don't remember it firsthand, I wasn't born, but Leonard Nimoy, you know, Spock in the 70s, talking about that there's going to be a new ice age and stuff. So I'm just not buying that we need to rework our entire economy and the infrastructure of all our energy in order to prevent some sort of runaway greenhouse effect. I just think it's liars.
It's hysteria. It's a kind of self-flagellation before the gods. There are things happening that we can't understand or that we don't like, or there's change happening and we don't like it and we don't understand it. And we've made a new god. And that god is Gaia. That god is Gaia. That god is the earth itself. And we will make a sacrifice. We will wear... We will do penance. We will wear uncomfortable clothing and silly.
Yeah, hair shirts.
All the stuff. I couldn't think of the word hair shirt. Exactly. We will do that, and hopefully the gods will be nice to us. And that goes back to a particular Christian theological view, wherein we feel that we can negotiate. We feel a sense of sin and evil, and that we're inherently bad, and we need to, and guilt. And that we have to do things to placate God, to show our sorrow and whatever to the gods, and B, that we have a sort of a sense of control over what we do. So it's almost like we can influence the gods. A different worldview of the pagans or even the Calvinists is no, there's no free will, and God is just in charge and he dictates things. So it's a particular kind of theology it reflects. So there's no reason for that to be congruous with the way things are. As far as I can see there's a very good book I've got here somewhere by James Dellingpole. What was it called now? Watermelons, it's called. And he looked at all the available studies, and it was very convincing that, as I say, carbon dioxide changes are a consequence of warming, not the other way around. This is a hysteria that we've got ourselves into, like the tulip craze or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, the psychology, one last thing to say on it, I find it very interesting, the psychology to think that we completely dominate human activity, completely dominates the climate of the earth, and that it's within our power to manipulate that and change that, or that weather patterns should stay exactly as they were in what the late 19th century through the 20th century. And any deviation from that is somehow an abomination, a human made abomination. And as you say, we have to flagellate ourselves over it. It just seems on a number of levels, like a psychological, some sort of malady of the mind, that you're not viewing the earth and climate in a normal, reasonable way. Seems to me.
You're viewing yourself and your own period of living as the only way things can possibly be, you've lost all knowledge of history. Yes, it's very very cold, and you used to have ice fairs on the Thames, if you go back to 1800 or something like that. But if you go back a lot further, you're growing grapes in many many parts of the UK, including in York. So that's how warm it was in the medieval period. And it was similarly warm, and there was a Roman cold period and a Roman warm period. So it's completely ahistorical. It's the idea that the way it is now is the way it always has been and the way it always will be. And if it isn't, it's a crisis, and it must be something we've done. And that fits into an adaptation where we feel a sense of agency, and we feel a sense that we can control things. And that leads to us feeling, well, all we have to do is just do something. We can just do something, and we can make things as we want it to be. It's a bit like, it reminds me of communism in the sense that there's this feeling that if we could just do, we have the power to change everything. And if we could just do something, then we could make the world better. And it forgets that no, humans are genetically hardwired in various ways. There's nothing we can actually do about it, that we're powerless.
Absolutely. So I feel like the idea that for ideological reasons, for science reasons, we shouldn't drill in the North Sea is just complete bullplop, and it seems that No Stone and Burnham has actually decided that we shall just drill in the North Sea. So, okay, I welcome that. Moving on to The Express then. It's a good paper. You can read your Express now. Do you like Alan Partridge, Ed? I think I asked you this before. You don't mind Partridge, but you don't like Coogan. Is that right?
We had this discussion. It's equivalent to Philip Larkin,
Yeah, that's right. I remember now, yeah. There's little stories in some of the papers. This 15-year-old girl and her mother both drowned in Essex, trying to save the 7-year-old, and the 7-year-old survived, but they didn't. I would say, if you can't swim, don't go in the sea. Seems to be quite a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, but some people this summer It's not that uncommon. They get in trouble in a reservoir, a lake, a river, the sea. It turns out they just basically essentially couldn't swim.
Yeah, what were they doing in there if they couldn't swim?
Yeah.
That was a very good idea.
Seems like a pretty straightforward cause and effect thing. Okay, reform pledge to build Nightingale prisons to keep criminals off the streets. New cells will end the early release scandal. One thing when I first saw this, I was like, what? What Nightingale? You know, sometimes when the world, whether it's adverts or whether it's the corporate mainstream media or whatever, they come up with a new term, a new thing. It's just made up that day. You've never heard it before. You're supposed to accept it as though like that's a thing. I was like, wait. Nightingale prisons. What are you talking about? I had to Google it. What it was.
Are they guarded by nightingales?
Well, what I really didn't know. So what, during the COVID era, they made sort of temporary, even prefab hospitals or jabbing stations, and they called them Nightingale hospitals. So it's right. A play on that. Basically prefab prisons. And they've decided to call them Nightingale prisons, and that's what Reform said they're going to do to sort of ease the release, the pressure on our prisons. My feeling is that we need to deport between 10 and 20 million people, and thusly, might be a bit of a lag, but thusly the massive amount of pressure would come off our prison estate. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, deport 20 million people, that's obvious. That goes without saying. I mean, that's just any reasonable person with any love for their country would accept that without question. But why does it have to be all these prisons? I mean, why not other things like flogging? I was reading, it's £60,000 a year. God knows why. They get rubbish food and they don't have much to do.
Yeah.
But apparently it's £60,000 a year to keep a bloke in prison.
Mm.
Right. Whereas surely, and you would agree, Bo, surely, you know, like 10 strokes with a birch can be done in seconds by a guy who's charged. But eager sadists would probably pay to do the job.
Mm,
mm. And so, you know, we can actually make it profitable. So maybe even if we were to put it on like stream it on like pay-per-view on the cable TV or on the internet, then it could be severely profit making. Wouldn't that solve a lot of that would solve the £60,000 a year problem, wouldn't it?
10 strokes of the birch. I mean, that's pretty wet. That's pretty liberal. I'm thinking more 200 licks of the cat of nine tails. That's what I'd like to see. Flay a man's back down to the bone, just like Wellington used to do.
That's a lot if you consider that it's 9 strokes per stroke. It's 9 cuts.
Yeah, you'd kill a man. That would kill a man, I would have thought. I'm thinking, though, actually, in Wellington's army in the Peninsular War, quite often you'd get sentenced to something like 100 or 200 lashes. And yeah, sometimes it would kill a man. Yeah, absolutely. So it depends on what your crime is, doesn't it? If you stole a sandwich from Greg's, probably 200 strokes of the cat is a bit much. But I would just like to see our population reduced massively, and it will take pressure off everything, wouldn't it? School classroom sizes, the waiting lists for doctors and dentists and the actual hospital and the prison. Just everything.
No, I mean, my primary school is now completely different from how it was when I went there. They've built all over the playground with little new classrooms. There was a school orchard to teach kids about growing stuff and that. That was built over even while I was there.
Mm.
So it was built a nice school with nice grounds and a reasonable number of people. The population is too high and it needs to be very heavily reduced, but it can't be reduced in such a way that people don't have children, and so then you just have lots of old people, because then you have lots of unproductive people, and you have a very conservative society that doesn't like any kind of innovation or new things or whatever. That's not the like is happening in Japan. Can't have that. It just has to be the mass deportation of people that don't have any business being in the country in the first place.
Yeah, Dan did an interesting segment on this earlier in the week, and he said sort of I can only agree with him, a program of mass remigration for a lot of people, strangers, foreigners, that should not be here, got no right really to be here, and also a set of policies that encourage natalism, encourage having children for the native white Brits, all sorts of tax and housing carrots to entice people to have more children more early in life for the native population. So the double whammy of those things, that seems good and reasonable to me. The idea that we need to import lots and lots of foreign people in order to care for our ageing population is obviously mad, because they themselves, assuming they stay, they themselves then become old, don't they, a few decades later. So you're not actually solving the problem in any sense.
You're actually making it a lot worse.
You're also
not solving the problem, because having an ageing population creates other problems. Even if you've got people from abroad or whatever who are looking after them, it creates a culture of a lack of innovation, of extreme sort of conservatism, and not in a good way. So it doesn't help. You have to have a young population. That's what we had in the 80s because of the boomers. We had a young population in the 70s, and look at all the innovation we had, all the interesting stuff, like all the interesting movies and original stuff, and all this. And now it's just remakes, because that's what happens in a society of people that are old, and it permeates out to the rest of the culture. You don't want to take risks. You don't like change, and so you have remakes. You know, now they've remade Little House on the Prairie. What's the point of that? Just watch Little House on the Prairie. What in the name of God is the point of remaking Little House on the Prairie? But they have. They've remade Anne of Green Gables. Constant remakes, nothing new. No risks.
They're going to remake The Waltons.
I wouldn't be surprised. If they remake Coronation Street, but like starting from the beginning.
It is interesting to see it play out. When you look at history, and you know a fair bit about history, and you see where cultures, certain civilizations, become effectively stagnant and inward-looking and just try and recreate the glories of the past. First thing that springs to mind, and there's so many examples of this in history, first thing that springs to mind is some of the later periods of Egyptian history, ancient Egyptian history, even by the Middle Kingdom, they're looking back and trying to recreate the Old Kingdom times and doing it in a far inferior way, that their innovation, their spark, whatever you want to call it, has gone out, and all they can do is try and reboot and remake and try and emulate what came before. And there's no real impetus.
They're not as clever. They've built civilization. They've built certain amenities of civilization, which makes life less harsh, and that means that people that are of lower intelligence are able to successfully have more children, and people that are higher up just don't want to have children because they're less instinctive and they're in an evolutionary mismatch where there's not enough death, and so therefore we know that if you prime people with death, then their instincts come out. This includes religiosity and wanting to have children. Look at the pyramids. Look at the way they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and so you could literally trace across time proto-pyramids that then get really big, and then it's the size of the pyramids parallels like the intelligence and the innovativeness of the population. It's fascinating.
There's a great number of examples of that through history where it just peaks out. They don't get better and better and more efficient. It degenerates. And I feel like just one data point is just like the state of Hollywood at the moment, or TV, that there's just endless remakes and reboots, and there's not much originality there. And the quality, and when things are an original piece, it's the quality isn't as good as it used to be. I think it's a very telling sort of data point. But okay, let's move on here. In the Independent, the banner, it's only the banner, I know it's not the actual headline, it's a banner, but let's talk about it anyway. It says, tax cuts, pints in pubs, are we heading for a snap general election? I don't think so. I think Burnham has said quite clearly a number of times he doesn't intend to hold a general election, but he is the Messiah without a mandate, isn't he? Beyond 25,000 people that voted for him in Makerfield and 330-odd Labour MPs that gave him his coronation. But Ed, what are your thoughts and feelings about Burnham and his mandate, or the lack thereof, and the idea of a general election? Would you like to see one? Are you indifferent?
Well, first of all, this idea that you don't have a mandate as Prime Minister unless you have won an election is a very new thing, and it's manifested because in recent history we've had two prime ministers that have become very presidential because they've been in power for so long. One, and also that came in on a mandate.
You're talking about Blair and Cameron, or Thatcher and Blair?
Blair and Thatcher. They were both in for a decade or more, and they both came in an election, so they inherently had a mandate. And then they made sort of radical change to the country and so on. And so we think of ourselves as this idea that a prime minister doesn't have a mandate if they're not elected. But that historically, we're going back to the norm now, the norm. It was a weird period of relative peace and relative economic security under Mrs. Thatcher, under Major Blair and Brown. It was this peculiar period that's unusual over the cycle of 100 years. And normally you go through prime ministers, and people didn't talk about when Jim Callaghan became prime minister. People didn't say he didn't have a mandate. He had a mandate because he had the support of more than half of the parliament. Of the House of Commons. That was his mandate. And people didn't say, when John Major, there was some murmurings about, oh, he hasn't won an election, because we'd had Thatcher for 10 years or 11 years. But even then, it's a relatively new idea that you have to have won an election to have a mandate. An election was won. But with him, it's more strange. I think we discussed this before. It's more weird with him because I can't think of another example in recent history. He wasn't actually elected to Parliament on the policies of the Labour Party at all. So the nearest equivalent would be them making some peer of the realm prime minister, something like that. And of course, a peer in Victorian times, and of course, a peer of the realm isn't elected. But on the other hand, you could argue, well, he was still a member of the Labour Party. And so in theory, we expect him to at least have implicitly supported the policies of the Labour Party, or presumably he would have left the Labour Party. So I'm not so bothered about this that he doesn't personally have a mandate issue. Yeah, I'm more bothered about I think that he has as much of a mandate as most prime ministers in history. He has as much of a mandate as Callaghan, as much of a mandate as Alec Douglas Hume, as much of a mandate as John Major, as anybody that has started midterm. What's more bizarre is that you have a person that comes in with a whopping majority, a massive majority, and then doesn't even last one term. I don't know when that last happened. That's extraordinary. It's absolutely bizarre. That's the weird thing.
Yeah, but of course, both Boris and Starmer that applies to, doesn't
both
it?
Of them. Yeah, I mean, both of them.
It's interesting you make that point. But I think while you were talking, I was thinking, but there's shades of it, degrees of it. So you're quite right to point out that Rishi didn't go back to the people. I don't think Liz Truss had any intention of doing that. Gordon Brown didn't. John Major didn't. A number of them, and going back through the centuries, even a number of them didn't. But then, and that's a fair point. But then there's degrees of it, though, aren't there? Where I feel like some examples are sort of more egregious than others. And in my opinion, I feel like the Burnham case is particularly egregious. Like, he particularly doesn't have... Because you mentioned there's an idea of a mandate from the people and a parliamentary mandate, like a popular mandate. I feel like his popular mandate is just not, is almost non-existent. It's just not really there. I wonder if he did, put it another way, I wonder if he did call an election right now, what the popular vote would be for Labour. And if it was shown to be really quite small, then, and they lost government, it would be fair to have described him as somebody without a mandate. But nonetheless, it's an interesting point you make.
John Major did go to the people. John Major did, I agree with you. He is a particularly egregious example because he wasn't even a member of Parliament at all when he decided to run for leader, and he wasn't elected under this as part of this government at all. So I can't think of any other example at all of someone that has come from out that was not involved in the election. The only one is Alec Douglas Hume. which is that Alec Douglas Hume was a peer of the realm. But he was a member of the government, though. He was a member of Harold Macmillan's government, and then he was made Prime Minister. When Macmillan stood in the whatever election it was, 59, Alec Douglas Hume was part of the cabinet. So I can't think of any other example of it. No, in that sense, you are right.
Was that Anthony Eden and then Hume?
Yeah, no, Anthony Eden, Macmillan, Hume.
Macmillan, then Hume. Right, okay, right, yeah. Okay, okay. I mean, just a very quick point on John Major. Didn't John Major coup out Margaret Thatcher in, like, 1990, 1991, and there was going to be a general election anyway in 1992, so he just waited till then, so he did just sit there. He didn't call an election right away. He just waited a year or 18 months before one was going to happen anyway.
Yeah, that's correct. He removed Thatcher was removed in November 1990, and he waited. He had to have an election because elections are normally every 4 years, but they have to be every 5 years. Mm. And he simply waited, then there was an election a year and a half or whatever after he became Prime Minister.
Okay, there's wildfires all across Europe, Ed. There's wildfires. Don't worry about that. It happens every year and it's perfectly natural, but there's wildfires. Be worried.
Well, there's more wildfires because it's hotter, because apparently there's not enough pollution. I saw one start once. I was about 1995 or something. Yeah, about 1995. Me and my parents were in I think it was Spain, maybe southern Spain. And we were sitting in the garden of some, you know, restaurant in the country, in the countryside, quite high up on a sort of mountain, I suppose. And we were just sitting there looking over this field, and we just saw this spark, and then everybody else watched as this field just caught fire down in the valley, and eventually I guess somebody must have telephoned the emergency services, and by the time the helicopter arrived and started spraying it with water, about half of this field was just on fire.
So spontaneous field combustion.
Just a little spark somehow. I don't know exactly what caused it, but a little spark, and you saw it. You saw the glint as it happened, and then it spread throughout the field. Yeah,
it's a perfectly natural phenomenon, isn't it? Okay. Well, in fact, it's required, isn't it, for the rejuvenation of part of the land. But okay, Burnham puts early prisoner release scheme on hold, says the Independent. Also, the Daily Telegraph. Burnham orders halt to early release. So that's one of the things. I made a point yesterday. I wonder what your take would be on it, Ed, that I find it concerning that the government, and not just Burnham, it seems like, but Starmer was guilty of it, and a lot of the last 10 years or so of Tory governments were guilty of it, of just seeming to react and changing national government policy on the back of, quite simply, if there's enough pressure or limelight coming from the media, then they will change policy. Otherwise, not. It seems to me this prisoner thing, because there was enough uproar in the media about those two young men that may well be released after dragging that cop along the road and killing him, now they're looking at changing the policy. And if there wasn't that much pressure on them, they wouldn't do. And I made the argument that that's an extremely shaky and extremely dodgy way of doing government. Do you think I'm overreacting, or I've just got the wrong end of the stick on that?
I think you're right. I think you're right, Bo. It's a double-edged sword. It's like Margaret Thatcher. She comes up with a policy, the poll tax. It's incredibly unpopular. She refuses to bend on it. She refuses to move. And that was the thing that helped to have her removed from power. But on the other hand, at least it's reassuring to think that you've got someone in charge of the country that has clear ideas about how things should be done, is confident in themselves and in what they think, has a plan, which they at least think is a good plan, which will have positive results in the end. One of the things that the Conservatives argued was, yes, it hurt, but yes, it worked. So when she came in, she said that the country is in chaos. We need to sort out this, the British disease of being governed by trade unions, of constant strikes, of us being the poor, sick man of Europe. We need to do these things. We need to denationalize, various industries that aren't making any money. We need to open up the economy so that we can make lots of money. These are the things we have to do. And these were incredibly unpopular when she was doing them at first in the early 80s. They were unbelievably unpopular. But but she said, no, we're doing it anyway. I don't care how unpopular I am. And eventually the results were there. And then she was re-elected in 87 with a massive majority, having done these unpopular things, having taken on the unions. So that's good. But if it goes too far, right, if you come up with an unpopular policy which nobody likes and you won't renege on it, then that's obviously the problem. But yeah, it just makes it look like they don't really have any ideas. They're just in power, but they don't know what to do with the power. They have no plan for the country. There are various problems that are very bad problems, like housing costs and too many people and inter-ethnic strife and low trust in authorities and all this stuff. There are various problems that need to be solved, and they've got no idea how to solve them. And so they're just living moment by moment, trying something out. Oh, it's not popular. It gets bad headlines. As it comes across, there's a weak, disorganized government with no plan. That's what it seems like to me. Whereas at least if they did it, at least they said, no, our policy is to release prisoners early. This is our policy. We think it will have positive consequences in the end. These are what they are. So judge us in a few years' time. Then at least that would be more reassuring that we have people in power that know what they're doing and have a clear plan for the country. This just makes them seem weak.
And in fact,
they've gone back on the policy on other policies that Starmer was going to bring in as well, like to do with pubs. There's other ones. It just makes ID them cards. Seem weak and just subject to the whim of the people.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't want a completely inflexible, completely deaf government, because that way lies like Ceausescu. Right, that's not good, but not to just run around like a headless chicken. I mentioned the Duke of Wellington at Waterloo. Now I'm not just gonna always react and run around like a headless chicken when something moves. I'm not gonna do that. That's, as you say, just weak. It doesn't just look weak. I think it is weak, right? So I feel like the real prerequisite to be in government is to have a vision of what you want and guts to stick by it when you get a bit of flack from the likes of the bloody Telegraph or the Metro. To stick by it, to ignore that noise.
It will be unpopular in the short term, but you have to have the confidence that that having done your calculations and so forth, that it will have positive results in the long term. And that's not the case with prisons. All they're thinking is prisons are overcrowded, human rights, whatever. We can't just stick loads of them in a room like they do in El Salvador. And what can we do? You know, let's just release loads of them. Oh, we're getting flak. We're getting emotional articles because a police officer was killed. This makes us look bad. We'll change up. We'll U-turn. And that's if the government U-turns, then that's when people just see the government as weak and they're not doing anything and they can't sort anything out. And so you might as well vote for somebody else.
Yeah. Quick story here. Won't spend too long on this, but in the ongoing trial between Trump and the BBC in Florida, I think it is, I find it fascinating that the BBC is trying to get Trump in the phase of the trial where you disclosure, trying to get Trump's like personal messages, even trying to prove that he did in fact want to incite violence on the 6th of January. So they've decided, it seems like, this article points that makes the point. It seems like the BBC have moved from just simply trying to say, sorry, yeah, the Panorama thing was disingenuous and disingenuous, and we're sorry about that. They seem to have moved their strategy to, now let's try and go on the attack. Let's try and prove that Trump did actually, in his heart or in his soul, or at least privately on messages, actually want to incite violence on the 6th of January. I just find that interesting and... have you got any thoughts or feelings on the Trump BBC trial?
I only hope that Trump hasn't kept copious diaries, because this is what did for David Irving. He sued Deborah Lipstadt and Penguin Books for claiming that he was a Holocaust denier and a Nazi sympathizer and a racist and whatever. And then in the disclosure aspect of the trial, he was open about the fact, rather foolishly, that he kept copious diaries. And they demanded his personal diaries during the disclosure, which he gave to them. And of course, then they went through the personal diaries and found him expressing his his thoughts and feelings in a way that weren't exactly helpful to his case.
Right.
So it's very you've got to be very careful if you're gonna they can basically ask for your diaries for like a window into your soul, and then use it against you. So it would be very, 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 that would be what they'd have to do. They'd have to prove that that they were correct. And therefore, I don't understand why that's the case, though. I mean, like, whether or not he did deliberately cause the January 6th riots, they still misrepresented him to make him seem worse than he was.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why that should be a defence. They didn't. I think they didn't have the evidence at the time for it to be correct to say. Whether they then subsequently get the evidence is irrelevant. So I think that's a bad aspect of the legal system. If you can say, no, we didn't have the evidence when we said it, but now we've gone and got it, and we are right. No, it should be you didn't have the evidence when you said it, so you shouldn't have said it, so you're wrong, and you have to pay out.
Yeah.
That works.
No, quite right, quite right. Here's a story I think is interesting, because where Burnham has come in and he said, oh, the US Air Force at least, can in fact use some of our air bases. I think they already were, but he's redoubled down and said, no, you can, particularly the B-1 bomber flying out of Fairford, RAF Fairford, which is not very far from where I'm sitting. It's just on the Gloucestershire-Wiltshire border. It's just north of where I'm sitting right now, RAF Fairford. Iran threatens RAF base, RAF Fairford, and royal family, indirectly, after wave of US strikes. Iran have just said, any base that US planes fly out of that bomb us, Iran, is a fair target. What do you think of the escalating war in the Persian Gulf? Are you concerned about, have you got Iran fatigue? Do you follow it very closely?
Yeah, I have. I've got fatigue. I just take the view, look, we need to have the attitude much more of a kind of an Edwardian gentleman in his club. That's what we need. And we need to say our civilization is based around oil. And that is very important that we get that oil. And if countries are going to mess up, countries that are relevant to our ability to obtain oil are going to mess us about, then we need to invade those countries. And that's it. Basic. We can't allow this. Who is in charge of the world? It is the Western people. We can't have this. And that would be in Edwardian England, that would just go without saying. We're not having this. You're not messing us around. You're not stopping us from accessing the resources that we need. You're not going to do that. And if you do, we come in. I can't believe we allowed the Iranian revolution to happen in the first place. I mean, it was ridiculous. We had a friendly dictator in Iran, and then we allowed him to be overthrown and replaced by these religious fanatics. And it's not good enough. I think we need to just go in there and sort it out.
Well, 1979, wouldn't that be Jimmy Carter? Jimmy Carter was a bit wet, wasn't he? He was never probably going to invade. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Here's an interesting, slightly interesting story. It says, Badenoch slams door on Shapps as MP. So that would be Grant Shapps. Anyone who doesn't remember, you must remember. He only lost his seat like last year or in 2024. Before that, he was Home Secretary very briefly under Truss. He was also Defence Secretary under Rishi. And he's just been in and around government and the cabinet for quite a few years. But he did lose his seat at the last one. And Kemi Badenoch, according to this, has blocked him even being selected to stand again. So this is all part of sort of her broader thing of trying to purge the Conservative Party of wets. What do you think about that?
Yeah, good. Good. She's good on her. Yeah. If we must have a foreigner as Prime Minister again, if we must have an anchor baby, a literal anchor baby, as Prime Minister that seems to have recently adopted an English accent. There's interviews with her talking in Nigerian accent like about 10 years ago. If we must, then I think we could do worse, perhaps, than Kemi Badenoch.
If we can have an anchor baby as the leader, at least have a based one, mildly based one, even if it is performative.
Exactly. If we must be ruled by a foreigner, then at least it could be a based one that's quite sort of funky. I think that's yeah. She's very short. She's very short. Yeah, I think she's tiny. Art conference. She's tiny. Yeah. Very big bottom.
Well,
I don't know if that's good or bad thing in terms of prime ministerial qualities.
As I understand it, fat bottom girls make the world go round, don't they? That's what I heard on the grapevine.
For gravity.
That's a Queen song, by the way, if anyone doesn't know what I'm talking about. Okay, this little story. Southport murderer moved to Broadmoor. So that guy, that Axel, whatever his bloody surname was, the Welsh choir boy who turns out to be just a sub-Saharan African monster, they say it's not safe for him to stay in Belmarsh. He's got to go to Broadmoor. And what he said earlier...
He's a mental, though. It's not safe because he's crazy, you mean?
Yeah, apparently, yeah. It's just not safe for him to not be in Broadmoor, and which is a secure hospital, which is, and another thing is much, it's a more pleasant environment for the inmate, actually. Much more pleasant, much less dangerous as well. And just one thing, we talked earlier about how much it costs to keep a fella in the clink. Yeah, it did cost something like 50 grand a year to keep him or anyone in Belmarsh, and it costs more like 300 grand a year to keep them in Broadmoor. Okay.
Well, that's outrageous, isn't it? That's outrageous. I think that we should make Rwanda pay for that.
Yeah,
we give government aid, we give third world aid to Rwanda. So I think we just reduce it by how much it costs us to keep him in prison because it's their fault.
He's 19 years old, sentenced to them a minimum of like 51 or 52 years. He could live for another 50, 60 years. That's, I mean. What's your feelings on the death penalty, Ed? I assume you're very, very pro-death penalty. Wouldn't you put this person to death, in all honesty, yeah, in all seriousness? I mean,
it goes without saying that I'm in favour of the death penalty. The question shouldn't be, should the person be executed? The question should be, by what method?
That's the
intelligent question, right? So, obviously, hanging would be for relatively minor crimes.
Hanging's too good for him, Ed. Hanging's too good for him. Nail him up. That's what I say. Nail him up.
Yeah. But we'd have hanging, drawing, and quartering for the really, really serious things, or burning for women. I think that's entirely reasonable, and I don't see how anybody could even consider arguing with us.
Ian
Hislop, he goes, oh well, this person was innocent and he was hanged. Yeah, he was. But normally they're a bit dodgy, aren't they? These people that are wrongly executed, they've usually done something where they're a bit dodgy. The only problem is that I think that Lucy Letby might be innocent, and they presumably would have hanged her.
Well,
so that's where there is some. Like, in all honesty, in all seriousness, that is where there is actually some concern.
Yeah.
So you have to have, but then that isn't, there's no, I mean, if you think about it, there's no real evidence that she's guilty, is there? It's just circumstantial.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be good enough. We would want witnesses. We would want, like with Rudolf Cabana, we would want witnesses, but proper proof, without beyond doubt.
Or DNA proof. I mean, for me, I am pro-death penalty, but even I would... In all honesty, in all seriousness, I would reserve it for cases where there's no doubt. It's not that there's a reasonable doubt, but that there's no doubt that there's very, very clear camera or eyewitness testimony, and probably would want slam dunk DNA, billions to one, that it's not your DNA type evidence. I would want there to be no doubt. Yeah, but in those cases, then.
But yeah, for example, there was a case in Scotland recently of a guy who... an academic at the University of Aberdeen, and he killed his wife supposedly in the early 70s or mid 70s, and then eventually, due to advances in DNA and things like that, it then quite recently he was put on trial for it and found guilty and sent to prison. But as far as I could see in that case, there was quite a lot of doubt. It was not a slam dunk case at all that he had killed her. So I want witnesses. Even DNA evidence. I don't know, but in that case, there was not DNA evidence that he killed her. There was DNA evidence that was circumstantial. Your DNA was on her clothes or something like that. Well, why was it there? But there wasn't actual proof that he really killed her.
Right. Okay, let's quickly move on. We're getting towards the, it's already nearly nine. Let's quickly go through this. Andy Burnham's in his number 10 North. There's a place called Heron House, just a building in the middle of Manchester. That's his new number 10 North. Do you think that's good in any way, or is that just pure gimmick to you? What do you think about that?
It's gimmick. Oh, come on. We're going to be in the North. We're going to be a bit different. We're not going to have a lectern when we do our speech in front of Downing Street because we're so laid back and cool and funky. We're going to be a bit different because a lot of people are working from home these days. And so I'm going to be like them. No, it's just a gimmick. God's sake.
Yeah, look how laid back he is. Look, he's holding a pint there. He's well laid back. Look, there's another thing.
On the other hand, though, do we want the Prime Minister? We talk about you want the Prime Minister to be intelligent and skilled and hardworking and a brilliant speaker and whatever. And so, well, then he's not representative of the people. But people go on about we want people to be representative of the people. You know, it's a problem that they've been to a posh university or it's a problem that they've been to private school or whatever. We want them to be representative. So if you do, then surely you want a Prime Minister that works from home, gets up at about 11 in the morning, gets up at about 9 in the morning, tunes in to make it look like he's working, goes back to bed, right? Gets up at 11 in the morning, starts, does a bit of work in his pants, you know, has a few wank breaks, works from home.
Easy, this is supposed to be child-friendly, Ed, come on.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Pleasure. Sorry, you said it now. Don't worry about it. It's all right.
Sorry about that. I didn't know it was meant to be child friendly. I wouldn't have thought there would be children watching your show at any time in the morning. But I apologise. Living in Finland, I'm used to the fact that I get up at like 9 and I put TV on and Family Guy's on, and kids could watch that. But of course, they think to themselves, "Well, the kids won't be able to understand it, so we'll just put it on because they can't understand English." Anyway, laid back and whatever, and with his cornflakes, and then that's a lot of English people these days, isn't it? They work from home, which is basically an excuse for being lazy. I should know. I work from home.
Yeah.
So, maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. He's a lot of people do that.
He certainly is laid back and normal working class guy. Look at this one. Look, Burnham. My night's out at the Hacienda. Anyone who's not old enough or maybe foreign might not know, the Hacienda was a very, very famous, really hip nightclub in Manchester, the Hacienda. And Burnham's saying that he used to go there because he's a normal fella with... Okay. All right. They're the front pages for one day, the increasingly absurd front pages. Let's have a look at our poll. Harry, can you bring up the poll for me? What did we ask you today? Oh, I asked you about a relatively serious thing. Over 1,000 votes, I asked you, will Trump need to put boots on the ground in Iran in order to win? That's what I asked. And the ayes have it. 72% of the Glorious Band, The Chosen Few, say yes. Not an insignificant 28% say no. They think it can be done just with an air campaign, I assume. What do you think, Ed? Is this Iranian regime ever going to crumble and bend the knee and just do exactly what the State Department and Israel want? Or is that just never going to happen without boots on the ground and an actual 2003 Iraq-style regime change? What do you think?
I think they are religious fanatics, the people that are in charge. And because they are religious fanatics, then it is very unlikely that they will willingly, it's like the Taliban, it's very unlikely that they will willingly or that they will, with any ease, give up power because they're religious fanatics. So they will fight to the absolute end, confident that Allah will support them and will guide them and all that kind of thing.
They're actually happy to be martyred.
Yeah. So I think that they will fight to the very, very end. And so I think that therefore it would make sense to just put boots on the ground. And it's such a shame. Iran is this historically highly significant country, you know, Persepolis and whatever. And frankly, it does have very, very good looking women who are the sort of exact balance between difference and sameness. So it's a shame. So I think that it's in our interest. I'm sure it's in our interest to just go in and just if you're going to take out Iraq, then surely you should go in and just take out Iran.
So with that said, what do you think then of the fact that the White House, the State Department and the Pentagon all have said and repeatedly say, and don't seem to be budging on, the policy of that they have no appetite for boots on the ground? What then? How do you square that circle there then?
Yeah, you can't. You don't. They don't have any appetite for boots on the ground because Trump has said that we don't want to get involved with foreign wars and all this kind of thing. But it's very, very important that the West has enough oil and to our standards of living, that oil is a reasonable price. It's very, 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 very important.
Yeah.
And so, nothing can function without oil. Nothing. It would be finished without oil.
Well, so talking of which, just to say, we sometimes check in with the live price of oil. Right now, Brent is just over $100, that psychological barrier of $100. West Texas, $91.50. So it's creeping up. It's getting back up there. Sorry, Ed, I spoke over you a bit there. Carry on.
No, I think it would be it's completely reasonable and entirely sensible realpolitik to invade the country and install. I think there's a lot of rebellions going on in Iran, as I understand it. There's a lot of people have had enough. Standards of living have gone down. People are very, very unhappy. There's terrible inflation, appalling prices of everything. People are very, very, very unhappy in Iran.
So yeah.
I think that it's on the brink anyway. So I think that it's in our interests as the West to push it over the brink and stabilize, like, as we did with Venezuela, or as Trump did with Venezuela. We need to stabilize and control our sources of oil.
If you was chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, if you was a four-star over at the Pentagon, would you be telling Mr. Hegseth and Mr. Trump, pull the trigger on this thing, let's go, let's unleash the big red one, let's drop all the airborne into Iran, let's mass tank divisions in the Zagros Mountains and race towards Tehran? Would you be advising that?
Well, I wouldn't. I'd have a lot more knowledge than I, Ed Dutton, have about the complicated dynamics of invading Iran. I'm sure it's very, very difficult and annoying. It involves mountains and God knows what. But I think it's getting to a point where it becomes reasonable to somehow remove that regime and help them towards a more friendly one.
Okay. All right. Let's do On This Day in History. I quite like doing that bit. Everyone else doesn't mind me doing that bit. I think it's interesting. If you don't mind staying with me, Ed, it's up to you, though.
Sure.
Cool. All right. So on this day, down through the centuries, what happened of a note, July the 24th? On this day in 1534, French explorer Jacques Cartier claims for France the islands around Gaspé, I think that's how you pronounce it, Gaspé, by erecting a 30-foot cross at some particular hill. So the French. First claiming Canada during the 16th century. Also on this day in 1567, Mary Queen of Scots is forced to abdicate. Her one-year-old son becomes James the Sixth of Scotland, who, as we know, goes on to become James the First of England.
That I can talk about because I've got a sub-chapter on her in my forthcoming book that's coming out next month on women.
Oh, tell us about it. Tell us about your book.
Yeah, so the book will probably be called Borderline Genius, Borderline Insane. And it understanding borderline personality disorder and how women with it have influenced history. And it looks at how basically women that are highly significant tend to have borderline personality disorder, which is marked by extreme moods, problems with anger, identity disturbance, self-harm, fear of abandonment, depression, these various traits. And I argued that, I looked at the most eminent women and I found that more than half of them had the traits. And then I looked at queens regnant, because I argued, because often if their fathers are narcissists, for example, or psychopaths, then this expresses in women as borderline personality. And so you'd expect these queens regnant to be like that. And that's what I found. And she was of the queens regnant that we've had in Britain that were absolute monarchs, i.e. that were actually in charge. She was the most extreme case. I mean, she was the most extraordinary woman. For example, someone raped her, and so then she married him. Or she had her husband assassinated, and then that person that killed her husband then took her away, abducted her, and raped her, and then she
was it married. Bothwell, was it?
Yeah. It's absolutely crazy woman. She had all of the traits of a BPD, as far as I could see. And even that case of the son, it was suspected that it wasn't even the father's son. It was suspected that it was the son of her Italian secretary. She was having an affair with her Italian secretary. And then her first husband, whose name escapes me at the moment, had the Italian secretary murdered in front of him, in front of her. She then had him murdered by this Bothwell, I think it was this Bothwell guy. And she absolutely, and so we don't even, can we even be sure that James the first was a father, was the sixth was his father's son? We can't, we know it was her child.
That's very interesting. She led an extraordinary life, didn't she? I will get up to it soon on Epochs, my history theme show behind the paywall at lotusteaches.com, because I'm up to Edward the Sixth. So it's probably only be a few more 10, 12, 15 or more episodes before I get up to Mary Queen's, because a remarkable life. And as you say, a remarkable woman.
Crazy. She was 6 foot tall.
Leggy.
Really tall for that time period, particularly for a woman.
Okay, on this day in 1832, Benjamin Bonneville leads the first wagon train across the Rocky Mountains through Wyoming's South Pass. I always find it remarkable how late it was in history, in the 19th century, that America expands out west. I always find that remarkable. I always do, that it is basically the 19th century when that happens. A lot, mainly the second half of the 19th century even. The first ever wagon train through Wyoming, 1832. You could reasonably expect that to have happened in the 16th or 17th century. But anyway, I find that remarkable.
Indian territory. So I presume that's why, it's because you have the Bonneville Salt Flats, don't you?
That's in Utah, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, which is, it must be named after him, I guess.
Maybe.
Which is a massive area where you can just drive a car really fast.
I've been to those salt flats, actually. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, Wyoming isn't very close to Utah, so there's salt flats in Nevada as well. Anyway, okay, on this day in 1911, American explorer Hiram Bingham rediscovers Machu Picchu, the lost city of the Incas. I don't know if you're familiar much with that story, but that's something out of a movie. He's literally sort of hacking his way through the forest and sort of through the canopy or through some bushes, just like, oh, there is an actual ancient lost city here in the mountains.
It's
very cinematic scene.
How quickly, if buildings aren't maintained, how quickly they become like, what's that car plant in Detroit? I went there a few years ago, and it's not been touched. It's been left alone since the late 50s, and no one's been. And it's falling down. All the glass has fallen out the windows and smashed. There's trees growing in the mid, like literally through the building. It's amazing how quickly, if you don't maintain it, it just turns back into earth, comes over it, grass grows on it, it just becomes what he found.
It's remarkable, isn't it? I once saw a very, very interesting documentary about exactly that. How long, if humans just disappeared, how long would it take before any evidence that we ever existed completely disappeared? And they said, with a few exceptions, like the pyramids, which would take a very, very, very long time for wind erosion to completely remove them. Other than a few examples like that, it would only be a few centuries. Even steel girded buildings would, after a few centuries, would collapse and fall down and all sorts of erosion. It wouldn't be a couple of thousand years at most, and nearly all the evidence that humans ever existed would be gone.
A book I've got coming out next year called The Reign of Dust, which is on ancient high forgotten civilizations, and I looked at this right at the beginning, but yeah, after a thousand years everything would have fallen down and be covered over by grass and whatever, and it makes it like the base of the Eiffel Tower would maybe still be standing, and the Hoover Dam and a few other things. Everything else would be gone, and even the pyramids wouldn't necessarily fall down, but they'd become covered in sand. Which they were substantially when Napoleon went to them. They weren't maintained, and so there was like half of them were just, they erupted in just sand.
I find that interesting. On this day, 1943, the RAF begins bombing Hamburg until the 3rd of August, creating a firestorm and killing 42,600 people during Operation Gomorrah. Got much of an opinion on the firebombing of Hamburg in 43?
Was this Bomber Harris?
It would have been.
It was pretty nasty, wasn't it? There's another book that I forget the name of it that I saw. You know the Old Speak bookshop that sells later in Suffolk.
Yeah, they're very good. Do patronise them.
The lady that runs that put up a photo of some book about what was done to Germany when it was liberated, and just the atrocities, like crucifying people, and just but the Russians did, and just God, that's appalling thing. Yeah, I mean it was an absolute war crime. Basically, Bomber Harris's policy was let's just kill lots and lots of civilians, and then they'll surrender. That was his policy.
Yeah. Yeah, area bombing, they would call it. Saturation bombing. Yeah, I mean, 43, the date of that is interesting to me. I mean, when you look at the firebombing of Dresden, it was so late in the war, very, very, very late in the war. Wasn't it in the early months of 45? It was right near the end. Seems to me completely and utterly unnecessary, but...
They destroyed Coventry, which was a beautiful historical town, and so we had to destroy Dresden to just get our own back.
I have heard that Hamburg, before it was almost wiped off the map in 43, was a beautiful, beautiful sort of medieval city. It was like largely at the centre of it was one of those examples of something straight from the Middle Ages, genuine example of sort of a medieval town, basically. But now, of course, gone. Okay, and the last factoid there was the one we already talked about, where a bunch of shill scientists try and peddle the lie that climate change is 99% the fault of humans. Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Ed. I appreciate it. Have you got anything else you want to let people know about, or where they can watch you and buy your many, many books?
Yes, well, there's The Jolly Heretic, which is my YouTube and Substack. And so if you like what I do, you can help me for the cost of a pint of beer a month. Then I've got a new film on Moldova, which is people seem to quite like, on a sort of neo-Byzantium, where we might flee to as the chaos happens, and unfolds and gets worse. And then, yeah, I've got various books that are available on Amazon. But I've got a new one, which I'm going to be coming out next month, which is on borderline personality disorder and the influence of women with it on history and on the modern day. So look out for that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, sir. Hopefully it's not too long before I speak to you again. And once again, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There you go, Professor Ed Dutton there. The good professor. Always a brilliant guest. He always knows what he's talking about. Got some great takes. Of course he has. All right. Should we do our Rumble Rants and Super Chats? And then that shall be the show. It's already knocking on towards 9:15. Okay, no, not in any massive rush, though. Not on the podcast today or anything. All right, let me do this with my mic boom so I can see the left-hand side of my screen where the Rumble Rants are. Do you think Global Church History is going to be in at number one? What do you reckon? Is it going to be a good day? Let's have a look. Let's have a look. Yes, he is reigning, defending, and still the champ of Rumble Rants. Global Church History says... Today, in 1969, Apollo 11 safely landed in the Pacific Ocean. Nice, cool. I believe in the moon landings. I do have some questions and reservations about Apollo 11 specifically, or Apollo 9, 10 and 11. I do think men landed on the moon. In my opinion, like Apollo 14, 15, 16, 17, it's just definitely real. It's just that they just definitely did. Do you have a slight reservation about Apollo 11? Haven't got time to go into it here, though. All right. Global Church History also said, on this day in 2019, US immigrant of Russo-Turkish descent Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. Alexander Johnson. You know, his first name is Alex. Only his middle name is Boris. Bo is my middle name. I go by my middle name. All right. But he called him US immigrant of Russo-Turkish descent. Yeah. I would have Boris Johnson's name at the top of my list of people to face the consequences of their crimes against the people and the nation. Alexander Boris Johnson. Okay. Pigdog5150 says... Great to see and hear Ed on the Real BBC, Bo's Breakfast Club, hashtag Bo's Breakfast Club, the Real BBC. Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's great. There's people that are just, they were born to be a talking head, right? Just give them a take and let them riff off of it. Some people are almost born to do that. I feel like Professor Ed Dutton's one of those people. Say, so, I enjoy Ed's man on the street work very much. Keep up the good work, Ed. Yeah, when he goes out into the public, does Fox Populi stuff. Very good. Shows you sort of the quality of Ed Dutton when you talk to, when you put him alongside just a normal, random person. It's just chalk and cheese, isn't it? Night and day. Okay, Fallen Firebird. Money is only a fraction of pronatal policy. The main problem is a spiritual and moral inversion in primarily women, but men as well. That cares nothing for our people's future. West Side problem. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. It's deeper than just the government saying, you know, we'll give you quite a good deal on loans for a mortgage if you have more kids. And suddenly people are like, yeah, let's just have six kids. Yeah, it's more than that, isn't it? You're right. A spiritual and moral inversion. Again, down through the centuries, the trend is very interesting to see that when people think that their country, their nation, their people, their civilization is in decline, that it would be the wrong thing to do to bring a child into this horrible world. You've got no hope. And then you see a massive decline in natalism. Very, very concerning to see it playing out in our world today, in the West, in England. Very concerning. Okay, and the last one for rant today is from Matthew C. How are you, sir? He's one of the super fans. Met him at the live show. Great guy. Matt, you say, Ed is referring to Hellstorm, the book on Germany in 1944-47. Truly horrifying. Currently reading it alongside Like the Roman. Is that a book called Like the Roman? Okay, Hellstorm. There you go. Yeah, it's pretty well documented. It's more in the East, really. More in Pomerania and more in East Germany, what became East Germany. The war crimes and rapes the Soviets did against the Germans. Many, many, most of them completely innocent civilians. Terrible, terrible thing. Absolutely horrific. A lot of them didn't even ever vote for the NSDAP. Were never in favour of Mr. Hitler's regime from day one. Yeah, horrible. Horrible thing that most histories just skate over. Not really. You know, you read a book by Andrew Roberts or something. You're not going to get much detail about that. His paymasters and publishers don't want him to talk about that. The Lord Roberts. Okay, shall we have a look at our YouTube Super Chat, shall we? If you can bring that up for me, Harry. I can't do that. Can you make that happen? There you go. All right. Lovely. Thank you. All right. Well, we've only got half a dozen or so this morning. Feeling Clumsy, 6968, says, good to hear yesterday that you are a Butlerian warrior. AI can, however, be used to limit bureaucracy. You will be replaced by the Bobot, though. Butlerian warrior. Is that like the in from Dune? Is that what that is a reference to? Like the Butlerian jihad? Yeah, I don't trust it. In fact, that was a story we didn't get to today, but it's in the news today, the news cycle today, that Kemi Badenoch. Well, there was more stories that loads and loads of AI testing has gone rogue and broken out of its sort of containment and tried to hack loads of things on the open internet. That's actually happened loads. It wasn't just this one time. Or that they nearly all tried to do it, and it's a worry. And Kemi Badenoch said she thought that AI, like unchecked, uncontrolled, unregulated AI development was a clear and present danger. That's her words. Exactly her words. Clear and present danger. And now I'm paraphrasing. That we, you know, we'll be sleepwalking into something nightmarish if we're not careful. Yeah. That's my feeling. Okay. Calzetti says, is it an Eamon Holmes joke? Where was Eamon Holmes on September the 11th, 2001? Curious. Oh, it's getting dark. The Eamon Holmes jokes are getting very, very dark. But where was he? Where was he? Probably do just need to tick him off the list. Poor old Eamon Holmes. Do I have to say it again just in case anyone doesn't know what the hell we're talking about? I've probably got to. In case there's new people watching saying, did Bo and the Load Seasters just accuse Eamon Holmes of being involved in 9/11? No, it's a very dark, very bad taste joke. I once accidentally, genuinely, in good faith, said Eamon Holmes when I was supposed to say Hugh Edwards. We were talking about Hugh Edwards. My mind was thinking Hugh Edwards. I thought I heard myself say Hugh Edwards, but my mouth actually said Eamon Holmes. A completely different person. Effectively accused Eamon Holmes of doing some bad crimes, which he is, of course, 100% innocent of. It's now a running joke. in my super chats and normal chat, that to accuse Eamon Holmes of doing things, despicable crimes. Yeah, it's bad taste, yeah. Poor old Eamon Holmes. In all seriousness, I hope he's okay, because I know he's had some health issues, isn't he? Didn't he have a stroke or a heart attack or something? Without any sarcasm, hashtag pray for Eamon. Poor Eamon Holmes. God. Emily for Restore says, most wildfires in Med started by rejected migrants. I can believe that. There's a big wildfire on Arthur's Seat up in Edinburgh the other day. Might be completely naturally occurring, mightn't it? They do seem to like to set fire to things, don't they? Disgruntled migrants. Like churches and cathedrals. They do seem to like that. There does seem to be a pattern there, doesn't there? Emily for Restore again says, love Ed's take on the IRGC. Thank you. He was like, let's get him. Like Scrappy Doo. Let me at him. Let me at him. I don't think that regime will fold under any sort of air campaign. Any sort of air campaign. Even a World War II era thing. I think they would just hold on. They're sort of happy to be martyred on some level. Or not even on some level. Explicitly. Okay. Brandon Lucas 9732 says, and it's the last one today, says, would you consider the past relationship between the Iron Age Bantu and the Sand Peoples and other Stone Age societies that surround them colonial? Would I consider that colonial? Probably. I don't know a fantastic amount. I've only got broad strokes of the brush knowledge on sort of Sub-Saharan African Iron Age history. But probably, yeah. Probably. Yeah. Loads of these people treated each other in a colonial fashion down through the millennia. Yeah. It's pretty normal. Pretty normal in the sweep of history to build empires and have colonies. Pretty standard across human civilization. All right, that's the show. It is now 23 minutes past 9 in the AM on Friday. Thank F, it's Friday, the 24th of July in the year of our Lord 2026. Thank you for joining me. You've been the glorious band, the chosen few, my band of brothers and sisters. Without you, the show is nothing. It really is nothing. Thank you for watching. Make the best of the day ahead. Carpe diem if you can. Enjoy the weekend. Try and make the best of your time over the weekend as well if you can. If you're at liberty to use it however you see fit. It's not very often the case, is it? But if you have, try and make it count. Try and do something valuable with your time. Because your time is finite. Especially when you're young, you feel like you've got endless days on this earth. You haven't. There's nothing more valuable to you than your time. Try and make it count. All right, I don't want to be too preachy about it. Enjoy the weekend, and I'll see you Monday morning. Take care.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.